Now I'm going to invite us to take a different kind of journey together. A journey through time and place to a city. This isn't just any ordinary city. Even though it is in the backwoods of a big, big empire, it may be out of the way compared to the big centers of Rome or Athens or Alexandria. But this city of Jerusalem is the central city for so many of those in this area of Israel and Palestine and Judea and Samaria and all of the surrounding lands. Long contested as a center for pilgrims through the ages, we're here in Jesus' time. At the center of the city is a hill. Located at the top of the hill is a building, a big, imposing building made of stone with fortress-like walls. Not only is this building near the center of the city, but it's also at the center of faith for thousands of people. The temple sitting at the top of the hill in Jerusalem, overlooking everything in the city. Some of the stones that make up this temple are massive. Single stone monoliths up to 40 feet long are piled on top of each other to make the walls. It's a monument to the one who built it and a credit to the people who worship there. Strong and formidable, just like Herod the Great wanted it to be. The temple in Jerusalem was Herod's greatest building project, a grand renovation of the holiest place in Judaism, designed to perpetuate Herod's name and legacy throughout the known world. Herod the Great, this man who was made king by the Romans to oversee their land holdings in Israel and Judea. Herod the Great, the man who, when he heard about the birth of a baby boy in Bethlehem, ordered the massacre of an untold number of infants in order to protect his power. Some 30 years after that massacre, a baby boy who lived through it is here, grown up, and in Jerusalem with his friends and disciples. Like good, observant Judeans, they go to the temple to pray. "Look, teacher, what large stones and what large buildings." No wonder one of the disciples bursts out with admiration of the temple. It was one of the architectural wonders of the Roman Empire. 40 years of work in renovation and only now just receiving the finishing touches. In sheer size, the overall area of this temple dwarfed the public buildings even in Rome itself. Devout Jews like this disciple were proud of it and felt that the power structure it represented was impregnable and eternal. So Jesus' reply must have shocked them to the core. "Do you see these great buildings? Not one stone will be left on another. All will be thrown down." They could have been forgiven for laughing at him or for getting shocked or upset. Here we have what sounds like Jesus talking about the center of faith and certainty, the dwelling place of God amongst God's people, the literal rock upon which their faith is grounded. And it sounds like he's talking about destroying it completely so that none of these giant stone bricks will be left on top of one another. Utter destruction. The next thing we hear is that the disciples and Jesus have climbed up the Mount of Olives, the hill opposite the temple. And Jesus is sitting there with Peter and James, John and Andrew. Instead of laughing or starting to panic, they ask him, "Tell us, when will this be and what will be the sign? When is this going to happen, Jesus?" And what follows is this terrible list of happenings: false teachers, wars and rumors of wars, earthquakes, famines. Not just the beginning. Some might read today's gospel and look around at all of the wars in our world, or at the devastating earthquakes that seem to happen with increasing frequency, or at out-of-control wildfires that cause unprecedented loss of life. And they might say, you know, Jesus was onto something. I guess the second coming is happening soon. And indeed, I read an editorial to that effect in the Pembroke Observer just a few weeks ago. And that knowledge of things seeming to unfold as Jesus said can make some of us feel secure in that certainty of prediction and having an explanation for why things are happening. But that's just it. Jesus didn't say, "Here's the checklist for my return." And if Jesus' return can only be heralded by dozens of people losing their lives in a wildfire or war rendering millions of people homeless, then I'd be tempted to tell Jesus to stay away. But Jesus didn't come to bring that kind of certainty of prediction. We have this long list of things that will apparently usher in the second coming. But when we hold that alongside Jesus' own sayings, that no one knows the day or the hour when the Son of Man will return, then I think we could agree that it might be a little bit more complicated than that. Not to mention the destruction of the temple that began our passage this morning. Well, that temple was destroyed by the Romans in 70 AD, and here we are, more than 2,000 years later. I've heard some say that this whole passage is merely symbolic, that Jesus wasn't talking about a literal temple, but about destroying religion, or that he was predicting that Christianity would replace Judaism. But that is anti-Semitic supersessionism. That's not what we believe. But when we hold this prediction of destruction alongside our other readings today, the reading of the Magnificat, the Song of Mary, another idea emerges. He has shown strength with his arm and scattered the proud in the thoughts of their hearts. He's brought down the powerful from their thrones and lifted up the lowly. He's filled the hungry with good things and sent the rich away empty. King Herod's building project was designed to bring glory to his name. And it's an empty project, a throne that owes its power to the massacre of untold number of infants is not the kind of power and authority of God's kingdom. A project that built a personal legacy off the backs of people being oppressed, impoverished, is not God's project. It's not God's mission. The Magnificat reminds us that the gospel turns things on their heads, turns the world upside down. A place where the last will be first and the first last. Where those who want to save their lives must lose them, where the powerful are brought down from their thrones and the lowly are lifted up, where unequal power systems are reordered in favor of gospel ones, in favor of God's kingdom values. This isn't about tearing down a building and replacing it with another, and it isn't about taking one political system or one religion and replacing it with a different one. It's about values that center God and that care for those who are oppressed and marginalized and impoverished, and that seek to change things so they're cared for. We don't have security and hope because we see fires in California as a sign of the end times and the return of Jesus. I can't rejoice in the face of needless suffering and refuse to think that that's from God. We have certainty and security because, as we will be reminded over the coming weeks as we journey through the season of Advent, Jesus became incarnate and came and lived among us. Because Jesus tells us that he is with us through all our lives, that he's making all things new, that God's kingdom is already here among us on earth, and that we get to participate in the renewal of the world as we participate in ministry and mission with God and with each other. And that, my friends, is the good news of the gospel. The good news that made Mary break into song. And the good news that we proclaim together. Amen.